Red Eyes Radio. Thank you for stopping by today. I hope you had a good Christmas and New Year's, and ready for some more radio as we get going here in the new year. You can find more of what we do at redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. We are going to connect back with Laird Scranton today. He's done work on some of the earliest cultures from Göbekli Tepe to the Dogon and many others in the East and Far East. Laird is an independent software designer who became interested in Dogon mythology and symbolism in the early 90s. He has studied ancient myth, language, and cosmology since 97. He has been a featured speaker at national conferences on ancient mysteries, including the Paradigm Symposium. He is the author of several books, including The Science of the Dogon and China's Cosmological Prehistory. However, our focus today is going to be on the European continent, the magnificent site of Skara Brae on the Orkney Islands in northern Scotland, the Neolithic farming settlement that is older than both Stonehenge and the Great Pyramids in Egypt, if you accept the official dating. Laird has a unique take on the site that puts it in a somewhat different light. Interpretation that this site is an early cosmological blueprint also includes some of the megalithic sites found at Orkney, like the Standing Stones and the Stone Ships. There are some remarkable details about the site that also connects it with the measure and traits that he's found at other sites in other parts of the world, this, though, being one of the oldest ones. Let's listen to what he brings to the table and see what you think. Hey, Mr. Scranton, welcome back. Thank you so much for coming on the show again. It's good to talking with you again.
Oh, I'm so glad to be back. I've been looking forward to it. As you know, you are one of at the top of my list of favorite people to converse with in interview format. So,
well, thank you.
I'm very glad to be back.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Laird. It was fascinating to have you on, and we've certainly talked about a lot of fascinating topics in the past, you know, and of course you've continued on that path, and I know that you have, well, you do have a couple of books in the pipeline. Of course, we are going to mention a little bit later in the program, talking more about Point of Origin, but you have something new in the works called, at this moment anyway, The Overthrown Boat, defining ancient Egyptian links to Skara Brae in northern Scotland, and you know, I wanted to bring you on to talk more about Skara Brae specifically, at least now in the beginning, because it's just one of those areas where we've heard so little about it. So little focus has been brought to it. People even hardly know that it exists. It's just such a fascinating place. So tell us first, Laird, how you got your eyes on Skara Brae. And I mean, because in the past, you've primarily been looking at, you know, the Dogon, people might know that, you know, but also, you know, sites like Göbekli Tepe and the Egyptian tradition and the Indian and things like this. But now you're focusing a little bit about up north here. What's what got you onto that track?
Okay, well, my progression so far has been sort of from Africa to Egypt to India to Tibet to China. And then the next upcoming book in February is called Point of Origin and ties all of those groups together to a common starting point in the era of Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. I intended to write the next book about the Maori in New Zealand. I was actually in process doing research on that when an acquaintance of mine, a Facebook acquaintance, emailed me and asked a question. He wanted to know if I had any sense of whether there could have been Egyptian involvement at Skara Brae. And that was a question that fell outside of my immediate expertise, but my habit with myself is to try to pursue any questions that people might ask me, because oftentimes they lead to things that help me. And so I began examining just superficially some of the elements there in northern Scotland, realized that the time frame was of the Skara Brae site is around 3200 BC, which is the era that I consider the Dogon tribe in Africa to have been Egyptian.
Right.
And the Dogon have done a very good job of preserving their traditions since ancient times. And so it occurred to me that if there had been Egyptian involvement in northern Scotland, that I should see commonalities to the Dogon.
Right, exactly. It's a very interesting island. It's been in number of different, number of different caretakers and number of different people have been there. More recently, of course, we have a Scandinavian influence in it from the 8th century up to like 1468, then it was handed over to Scotland. Before that, it's believed that it was occupied by Pictish people, and there's still a lot of question marks as to what actually happened there, if it turns out that the, you know, Vikings basically eradicated the Picts, did they take off before that? There's a number of question marks, which is interesting. But let's just kind of back up even more, of course, because the period that we're talking about in Orkney is much, 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 much further back than that. So give us a brief history of this area and these islands there overall, because it's just a fascinating area, this one.
Well, okay, the immediate site is a little cluster of stone houses from the Neolithic period around 3200 BC. So this is before dynastic Egypt. There is fairly scant evidence as to who the people were who were there, why they were there, where they came from. Researchers have had a hard time connecting the languages there to Scandinavian roots. There are architectural features in the buildings that don't connect to Scandinavia. There are pottery features that don't connect and so forth. The history was that the site was covered over by natural forces, some people think deliberately covered over, for around 4,000 years until around 1850 when a series of storms hit the island and uncovered a piece of it. And the gentleman who owned the land that the site is on, his title was the Laird of Scale, realized that there was significance to the site, devoted the next 8 years of his life and a fair amount of his fortune to excavating the site and trying to preserve it.
Interesting. Yeah, tell us more about what we find there on the location, what kind of buildings there is, because it's just, I mean, as you said, just to interject that quickly there, but the aspect of why it's been covered up potentially is very interesting because it makes a parallel to Göbekli Tepe. We can talk about those connections a little bit later.
Yes, and actually I think there are connections. But the site itself, it's clear that whoever lived in the site were farmers. This represents a change for Orkney Island area. From around 3700 BC or maybe a little earlier, we find evidence of single-family farms on Orkney Island. But this represented a group of families clustered together to work farms, to work a farm.
Yeah.
They also tended animals. It looks like they may have done some minor fishing, but it was not a major pastime of theirs. But then also nearby the cluster of houses, there are a series of megalithic sites that may come into play. And so the question was who were these people? Why were they here? And who are they related to, genetically and so forth?
Yeah, what do we know today? Because obviously there's no written language and there's a wide, probably a pretty good gap between when it's believed that they, left or if they died and couldn't, make it further. We don't know that, but there's nothing like that left to us. What do we have? We have pottery and like some kind of symbolic things, correct?
Yes. Now this is where the previous two books that I've worked on have worked to my benefit. I have a book that was out in August that's called China's Cosmological Prehistory, and the situation in China is similar. There's a period of several thousand years where there are no records, and so there's a gap that has to be somehow bridged in order to make interpretations or to anchor an interpretation. In the Point of Origin book, we're talking about events that had transpired around 10,000 BC, so maybe 7,000 years in advance of written language. And so I've been forced to develop other approaches to trying to, to anchor an interpretation, to find a way to demonstrate that this was an intended way of looking at things. Now, many of those things have to do with language, and they have to do with a couple of important features of language. One is there's a tendency the farther back in time we go to find more and more commonality of language between cultures. And so that allowed me to use Egyptian and Dogon dictionaries to help explicate words in ancient China, whose meanings were not clearly understood in China. Mm-hmm. There are hieroglyphic connections that let us positively tie one language to another. There's also a feature of language called ultra-conserved words. This is the tendency of words that are important to a culture remaining in a language for very long periods of time. And so because of that tendency, many times we can take a modern dictionary of a language and find traces of ancient elements that we can positively tie to. And so one of the ways that I approach these questions is by comparing language, comparing words.
What do we have there then in terms of, because I know that there's some, I guess, a kind of a proto-writing that's been found, like in different patterns and zigzag symbols on different houses there, correct?
Yes, there are. And actually, none of my arguments right now are based on actual inscriptions found at Scarabray. I know there are people who have tried to interpret them, but I don't see enough significant writing there to be able to base an argument on. What we do have, though, are, as I say to begin with, were the suggestion that there might be commonalities to the Dogon. And so my approach really started with that. I say, began with just, I mean, any interpretation begins with the resemblances, and some of those resemblances turn into fair interpretations, and some of them don't. So I started very superficially by saying, okay, what is there about this village that rules out the possibility that it could have been a Dogon village? And I started comparing an overview, what does the Scarabray site look like compared to a modern Dogon village, and realized that they are within the ballpark of each other. There is nothing glaringly obvious about the site that says that it couldn't be a Dogon village. In fact, it has a lot of features that are in common with a Dogon village. The height of the walls that were built, the style of construction, the way the passageways were placed between buildings, some of the structural features that are included within the village itself align with what Dogon villages are today. So that was a good starting point. It becomes more significant when you start looking at individual types of structures. And this is where I started to understand that there might be a connection here where I thought there probably wouldn't be one. The one key factor is the way that the Scarabray houses are configured. To describe how it is laid out, the significant feature is a round, what is referred to as a beehive cell room at the top of the house. Along the sides of the house are two rectangular sort of bed insert chambers. There's a central body of the house where there's a hearth, a squared hearth, and there's a doorway at the bottom of the house on the opposite end from the beehive round room that is the doorway. Now, that layout happens to compare favorably to the typical layout of a Dogon house, including this beehive cell room that Scarabray researchers were calling a unique feature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, now, if we interpret the house according to the Dogon plan, we know that the side rooms are bedrooms, the rectangular rooms are bedrooms, the top room was probably a kitchen, the doorway at the bottom represented the doorway in and out. Neither set of houses had, neither house plan had windows. The Dogon are known to say, if I want light, I'll go outside.
Right.
But there's also cosmology to the Dogon house that's very important here. In other words, the Dogon don't build their house just because they randomly learned to build it that way. There's an intellectual basis for how the house is put together that's based on cosmology. The plan of the house is akin to Schwaller de Lubitz's Temple of Man at Luxor in Egypt. This house represents the body of a person. The Dogon say it represents the body of a woman. And the round room at the top represents a head. The long rectangular rooms represent arms. The central body of the house represents the body cavity. The square hearth in the middle represents a heart, according to, I mean, based on that outlook on the plan. And the doorway represents the woman's female parts. It's the entry point. Now, what's interesting about the comparison is that my perspective was that the Dogon influenced the Northern Scotland house plan. And so it was interesting to me that because the Dogon live in a desert climate where they don't need hearths inside their houses, that whoever implemented the plan at Scarabray added a hearth, but they added it in such a way that it's in keeping with the cosmology of the house. They added a square hearth that stands in the place where a heart would be and named it as if it were a heart.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the biology works with the added feature of the house. That seemed very interesting to me that someone would have been that devoted to the cosmology that they would have included a feature that wasn't in the Dogon plan. So then what I was able to do was use language to confirm that in the ancient – okay, there's an ancient language in northern Scotland called the Faroese language.
Yeah.
And no one is quite certain where the roots of these words come from, but we do understand from a modern perspective what the what the language is. You can get dictionaries and so forth. And the word I could see that the word for kitchen is connected with the word for head, and the words for arms were connected to the idea of a bedroom. And going forward with other features of the house, I could connect various Faroese words to various Egyptian and Dogon words, and also various words of cosmology, to be able to line up the features of the house with the things they were supposed to represent. In other words, it looks to me as if whoever put the house plan together at Scarabray understood the cosmology in the same way the Dogon did.
So we can kind of assume, of course, that these are seafaring people. They got there somehow. I mean, but at the same time, we're actually very, very far back in time here. What's the possibility that the geography looked very, very different and that they perhaps walked by foot there over the straight between France and England? They even call that Dogger Land. I think they actually call it. It's sand today and fairly shallow. But at some point, there's believed to have been a land bridge there. And even if we possibly go further up north in Scotland, do you think that it could have been a lot of land there now as where there's water?
Based on the references I've seen, I don't think so at 3200 BC. I can't say that there wasn't at some point in the past. But Orkney Island is very accessible from the sea. It's the harbors are very easy access. The ocean currents from the Atlantic would bring a ship, almost automatically bring a ship to Orkney Island on the way as they come up north through the Atlantic currents. They swing you around north of Orkney and back towards Ireland. It seems like a natural place for a ship to have ended up if whoever was there came there by ship.
Yeah.
That the actual origins of who was there are problematic in a lot of ways, but the sort of running before we walk.
Right. Yeah. Well. Exactly. No. Of course not. It seems to be, and I want to talk a little more about this later. But it seems to be that the preservation of a style of early human settlements have been preserved in some areas of the world, and it seems to have been spread, and that's obviously relates to the point of origin that you have written about and want to we can talk more about that later. But before we get deeper into that question, let's just kind of describe a little bit more about the site here first of what we're looking at, because we have how many houses are there now? Is this like 7 or 8? And how big are there? How many families do you think live there? How big was the population, do you think?
Okay, well, the traditional outlook is that there were 8 or more families inhabiting the site. There are, it looks like, dwellings for 8 families, but it looks like there might have been a more cooperative style of living, so it's hard to say that it strictly was 8 families. The construction itself is drywall construction, just as the Dogon construction is. Orkney Island has a plentiful supply, or had a plentiful supply of shale-type stone. I mean, stone that was easily broken into squared pieces that could be stacked to create a wall without any mortar or anything necessarily in between. So it's a very simple style of construction. The houses interconnect with one another. There are passageways between the houses. Now, the next feature of the village that connects to the Dogon is a round building. Every Dogon village includes a round structure built to half height that's called a toguna. It's a men's discussion house. And the concept behind the toguna is that it's a meeting place. Anytime any two Dogon villagers find themselves in a dispute, they're required by Dogon law to go to the discussion house where they can only sit, they can't stand, and all parties who have an interest in the dispute are required to stay in the discussion house until they resolve it.
Right.
And as a consequence of that, Dogon villages tend to be very peaceful because no interpersonal issue is allowed to fester. They're always resolved very quickly, and they're resolved as a group. Well, at Scarabray, we have an almost identical matching structure. And so the suggestion is that if the people there were in knowledge of the same cosmological system, that it makes sense that they would have implemented the same type of building in their village. Outward indications are that the Scarabray site was also a very peaceful place. They have found no weapons, no evidence of warfare or whatever on the island near the site.
Interesting. Yeah, it sounds like a ting a little bit. We have in Scandinavia, it's your ring of stones where decisions were made and heads of the families or whatever gathered to actually work out things, problems that arose within the society or what have you. But what about the megalithic structures then? We do have standing stones there. I think one is called the Stennis stones. There's the one they call the Odin stone, what have you. They seem to have been, well, as they possibly know, erected kind of in the same time frame, have they not?
Yes, they were. And the Scarabray site is thought to have been in use from around 3200 BC to around 2600 BC for around 600 years. Those megalithic sites, okay, once we understand that the house at Scarabray was built on the same cosmological plan as the Dogon, we're now in a position to consider cosmological interpretations for the megalithic sites that are nearby. Now, there are a series of megalithic sites that in Neolithic times were connected with what's called a low road that ran past the sites in a particular sequence to Scarabray. Now, when we understand Dogon cosmology, we understand that there is a prescribed sequence to how stages of creation happen. The best way to understand the sequence is to consider it in relation to an aligned ritual shrine like a Buddhist stupa, which the Dogon also create. There's a series of geometric shapes. When matter forms, it begins with a single point, and then the concept of a circle around that single point. At the bottom of matter exists in wave-like form, in a form that has virtually no mass, and based on Einstein's formula E equals MC squared, as you reduce mass, you increase time frame. So at the bottom of matter, we have an environment that is almost massless, but that also exists in an almost infinitely fast time frame in relation to ours. Events transpire much, much more quickly than they do in our relative frame of perspective. So the way that matter forms, according to the Dogon, is an act of perception disrupts this massless wave and causes it to draw up. And as it draws up, it twists and it encircles and it creates the equivalent of what cultures refer to as a primeval mound. That drawing up process then causes the waves or the threads that represent the waves to encircle and create little bubbles that, to begin with, are so insubstantial that they have a hard time even holding their own shape. And it takes 7 or 8 of these bubbles together to create the fundamental structure of matter, which the Dogon refer to as the egg of the world. This is the counterpart of a Calabi-Yau space in string theory. So on Orkney Island, we have a series of megalithic structures that repeat these key shapes in sequence, these key creational shapes in sequence. And not only do they do that, they also do it using traditional names on Orkney Island of locales that tie out. They make sense. They're sensible words in terms of the cosmology of the Dogon and the Egyptians. For example, the concept of a ness in Scotland, the etymology of the word is not precise. There are very few words that they can precisely trace. But the idea of a ness is it's thought to represent the idea of a headland. It's a point of land that sticks out of the water. But in the Egyptian language, ness doesn't mean, in Scotland, it represents the concept of a nose, which is a similar phonetic value to an S. In Egypt, it represents the concept of a tongue, and there's actually a plant called the tongue of the sea that is based on the word Ness. You can see that at the sites in northern Scotland, that either of those terms would accurately describe the locales that are described as Nesses. It doesn't matter whether we're describing the tongue of water that inserts itself or the tongue of land that sticks out into the water. You can describe the same site. So the first megalithic site that we see on Orkney Island is called the Watchstone of Stennis.
Yeah.
Now, Watchstone, conceptually, represents an act of perception. It's the single point. It's a single geometric point. That's the first stage of this creational process. Now, what it leads us to next is a circle called the Standing Stones of Stennis. And that's those standing stones are the equivalent of the circle that appears around the central point in cosmology. When the Dogon used that circle to align a shrine, that central point and the circle represent the concept of a sundial. They can use it to measure hours of the day and track how long a day is. But they can use some additional geometry to plot a couple of points very simply that create an aligned line that's aligned east and west that they can use to track the solstices and the equinoxes of the year. They can use it as a tool for agriculture. And so the Stones of Stennis are based on, the name of the site, the Stones of Stennis, is based on the word sten. In Egypt, the word sten means to distinguish winter from summer.
Hmm.
So if we're interpreting, if we take the liberty of trying to interpret these sites in terms of Egyptian roots, we can understand both the shape of the Stones of Stennis based on the cosmology, but we can also understand its purpose based on the Egyptian word.
Interesting. Stone means, stan means stone in Swedish, by the way. it's properly ascribed there. And then, you have a lot of different, but I mean, let's just for a moment just talk about the comparisons then to the comparisons to other megalithic sites in England, let's say. I mean, even the Ring of Brudgar, it's like these are very similar to some of the Stonehenge type structures and what have you. Are we to, believe that this is the same culture that is at work up in Orkney at that time as well?
Well, it's certainly the same cosmology. The cosmology is connected with so the idea that where we find successful farming after 3200 BC, if they had a ring of stones, that's one of the prerequisites for successful agriculture is being able to determine when the seasons are. And the stone circles allow them to do that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's very difficult to say, of course, but it's tempting to assume, because it was a fairly small amount of families that ended up there, and for some reason they left. We can talk more about that later, but should we view it as a kind of a colony that's, further spread up north, maybe even looking at the axis of new farmland, etc. Maybe even the environment, climate-wise, was actually a bit milder than what it is up there today, for example.
Well, I think that the traditional outlook is that this was a group of families who banded together or a group of farmers who banded together to create one of the first examples of a village, a farming village. That's the traditional outlook. As we move on with exploring some of the symbolism, there are reasons to think that there might be some other things going on there, too.
You want to get into that right away?
we could do it if you like.
Sure, let's do it.
In the Dogon cosmology, as we proceed through these stages of creation, the Dogon successfully describe a credible system for creation of matter that seems scientific. One of the early books I wrote displays Dogon descriptions and drawings side by side with descriptions and drawings from Brian Greene and Stephen Hawking, and shows that the Dogon understanding of how waves turn into atoms is a reasonable outlook scientifically. Well, we know that one phase of this process is the process that causes waves to create this little egg of the world that I'm saying that as we step forward with these megalithic sites, I guess we stopped at the stones of Stennis, the circles of stones at Stennis.
Yeah.
The next structure is Maze Howe, which is an example of a primordial mound. And the next stage beyond that is Scarabray, which is a cluster of eight houses. Now, that cluster is a conceptual correlate to, in Dogon cosmology, the cluster that makes up this little egg of the world. It's a structure that supposedly exists at every point in space and time. It's a little cluster of wrapped up dimensions. Okay, but the Dogon system of matter doesn't stop at that cluster. There are other stages that go beyond it. And so when I realized that what I was looking at on Orkney Island was, seemed to be a progression of cosmological stages that led to the Scarabray site, the immediate question was, well, could they have continued beyond that egg of the world? Could they have tried to represent the next stage? Now, in the Dogon system, the next stage is the stage at which fundamental particles form. Now, if you think of, there's parallelism in the Dogon system between how matter is created and how the universe is created. And as the universe forms, you end up with sort of primordial vibrations against a background field. Same thing in talking about matter. These fundamental particles exist against a conceptual, what's conceptualized as a background field. A structure that has differentiated itself from the background field. Okay, now one of the ways that the Dogon represent this in their cosmology, each of these fundamental particles represents a vibration of matter. And vibrations are seen by the Dogon the same way they're seen by us. You see, remember the up and down diagrams that represent a vibrational wave in science,
mm-hmm.
either a zigzag line or a circular cycle of lines that go up and down. Well, the Dogon represent vibrations with zigzag lines. And every year, just before they plant their crops, the Dogon go to the field of their lead priest, a priest who's called the priest of Aru, and they draw a circle in his field, and inside that circle they draw a series of zigzag lines that represent all of the vibrations of matter. So we know on Scarabray that we have the farming village, but we also have, presumably, the field that was farmed by the farmers. So realizing of that field might also have some cosmological significance, and also realizing that in the time period we're talking about, we're not talking about the Dogon, we're talking about Egyptians, or pre-dynastic Egyptians. I wanted to demonstrate for myself that the Egyptians had a comparable concept to this field of Aru that the Dogon have. And for the Dogon, this field exists on two levels. It's a cosmological concept that's purely theoretical, but it's also a drawing in an actual field that's actually going to be planted with crops. It's a physical agricultural field. So I went to the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary. Knowing that the Egyptian word for field is seket, I started exploring to see, was there any Egyptian term that could be comparable to field, you know, the field of Aru, and discovered a term that's called seket Aru. Now, budge describes, okay, literally that word means field of Aru, but Aru also means reed. So budge describes that as the field of reeds. But he also mentions that the term field of reeds is an alternate term for the concept of the Elysian fields, which is the ancient concept of heaven that the Egyptians and the ancient Greeks had. Now, the Elysian fields is a sort of a complex concept because in some texts it's treated as if it were a theoretic thing, and in other contexts it's treated as if it were an actual physical place that people were said to have traveled to and to have gone there to experience what life might be like after death, and there are physical descriptions given of where it's located and what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those physical descriptions tie out to what we find in Orkney Island. It's described as being a single island, a white island, and at Orkney Island we have brilliant white beaches. It's described as being a place of great winds, which is probably the major climatic feature at Orkney Island.
Yeah, oh yeah.
In ancient pictures, I mean, you have representations of the Elysian Fields in the Egyptian Book of the Dead and in Egyptian artwork and things like that. And the things that are represented there are all a very good conceptual fit for what we find on Orkney Island. The Greek writers tell us that it was located far to the west side of the continent, within the waters of the coastal ocean, which is what Orkney Island is. They even assign words that sound like Orkney to the island itself. So there's reason to think that what's represented on Orkney Island may have been what was being described in these ancient Greek texts as being the physical locale of this mythical Elysian Fields.
It's very interesting, and of course, the Elysium, they also call it the Fortunate Isles, right? I mean, the Blessed Isles, that's kind of a thing that people apply to Ireland today, but or Britain overall, actually, right?
That's right, and also there are linguistic connections to the Faroese language. I also have looked at Icelandic and Gaelic and some of the other languages in the region to try to find common roots and different perspectives on what the roots might mean. But each of the Greek descriptions, including Fortunate or Blessed Islands, are connecting to linguistic roots that exist at Orkney Island. Now, as I proceeded through this this exploration, thinking that what I was looking at was Egyptian and Dogon influences on northern Scotland at 3200 BC, I slowly came to realize that perspective didn't make sense. There were things that flew in the face of that perspective. The first was what I had mentioned before about the existence of the hearth in the house plan on Orkney Island. It made far more sense to me that the hearth had been an original part of the structure, and that the Dogon had removed it because they lived in a climate where they didn't need an internal hearth in the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then it made sense that it went the other direction. Also, I know that in Egypt at 3200 BC, the traditional view is that there wasn't enough cultural organization in Egypt at that time to have mounted an expedition as far away as Scotland and Ireland, and to have put effort into constructing these megalithic sites all that distance away from home. It didn't make sense that might have happened. But then I started to entertain the possibility, well, what if the influence went the other way?
Right.
What if what we're looking at is not Egypt having influenced Scotland, but Scotland having influenced Egypt?
Uh-oh.
Now, in my book, Point of Origin, okay, the Dogon tradition is that their teachers, the teachers who brought them this information about their cosmology that's very scientific and the civilizing skills that they have for agriculture and things like that, their teachers were deemed to have been non-human. This is also true in Buddhism. It's flatly stated that the teachers who brought this kind of knowledge were non-human. But the Dogon also say that their teachers were non-material, and that created a problem because the teachers were concerned about what the detrimental effects might be on us of being around them. And their solution to that problem was they took 8 Dogon tribes people and sequestered them at a remote locale, instructed those 8 in the civilizing skills and the science, and sent them back to instruct everybody else.
Right, yeah.
Now, I know that all around the world in various regions, we have that similar tradition of 8 ancestor teachers who came with civilizing skills and taught people. Now, at Orkney Island, what we see are facilities for 8 families.
That's right.
So it's conceivable that Orkney Island could represent one of these instructional sanctuaries that people were brought to be taught things. This is the interpretation that I'm presenting in Point of Origin for Göbekli Tepe, is that at 10,000 BC, there was an effort that the Egyptians referred to as the first time, and the Buddhists referred to as the first time knowledge was passed to humanity by Buddha. That term, first time, implies that there was more than one attempt made. Otherwise, they would just call it the time.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So the idea that there might have been a secondary attempt at instruction isn't inconceivable in the scenario that the Dogen have presented. Now, for the Dogen, their teachers they referred to their teachers as the Pneumo. And the Pneumo were some way intimately connected with water, for one thing. We know that the Pneumo had the very best intentions of the Dogen at heart. Everything we're told about them illustrates ways in which somebody seems to have not pulled any punches with us in terms of trying to help us get a leg up on civilized culture and science.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Now, on Orkney Island, the earliest reports of inhabitants on Orkney Island describe two groups. The first group, called the Pete, are described as being of very short stature and of very strange habits. The second group, called the Pape, are referred to as clerics. They're said to always wear white, and the Dogen always wear white. That's their traditional garb. The Pape are described as wearing tunics, and the Dogen also always wear tunics. And some of the early descriptions, which are in sagas in Scandinavia, which are not very descriptive. I mean, they provide the minimum amount of detail. But at one point it's commented that the Pape were so different from the Scandinavians that they might have been mistaken for a different race as opposed to a different profession.
Just hold it there, pause there. I just want to ask you a bit more about the words themselves and what language you've... tell us how Pete and Pape, how you spell those, and what language you found those in.
Okay, these are given in terms of Scandinavian references to Orkney Island, given by English authors. Pete is being spelled P-E-T-I, and Pape is being spelled P-A-P-A-E.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Okay.
Now, I know at Caithness and places like that, there are traditions that early inhabitants there were black. I know there have been DNA studies on Orkney Island that reflect a surprisingly high influence of DNA from outside of the region, widespread regions, including the Tuaregs, which are connected to the Dogen in northern Africa, and DNA haplogroups that connect to ancient Egypt. There's a 1% representation in modern Orkney men of these genes that tie directly to Egypt and to northern Africa. So it's not unthinkable that there could have been influences. We can't demonstrate from that when the influences were or where they came from, but at least we also can't rule out that there were influences. So the very short-statured Pete were also described as being pygmies. Now, the Egyptian word for pygmy is nem, and nem is the root of the Dogen Pneumo. We also have later traditions, thousands of years later, of origins for the Druids that are passed through a group called the followers of Nemed. So we have this phonetic root Nem that plays out in several different instances in connection with the region in Ireland and in Scotland.
So we have a kind of a, just to clarify this a little bit, we have a kind of a blueprint of sorts that have been, you know, and of course, which direction this goes can be debated, but there's a blueprint that the Dogen primarily have kind of hung on to this one, a kind of a freezing, and therefore we can look at that and then see, okay, where does that apply? Are there similarities in other parts of the world, etc.? But what you're talking about here in Scarborough is basically not the first time, because we have Göbekli Tepe as the first time, that kind of attempt, I guess. But here we have something which implies an influence at a later time of a kind of a teaching center, for the lack of a better term, of this blueprint system of how to build civilization of sorts. Would that be a fair kind of summarization?
Yes. I'd say that the goal looks as if it was to establish self-sustaining kingdoms or civilizations at various points on the planet that are founded on a self-sustaining agriculture. And Orkney Island looks like a place where agriculture was being taught and where cosmology was being taught. Now, at Göbekli Tepe, during the era of Göbekli Tepe, the sanctuaries that we encounter are all high mountaintop sanctuaries. They're far removed from where your average hunter-gatherer would have been. It provides a safe haven, if you will, for whoever the teachers were, a place where they could go and not be bothered by anyone. By 3200 BC, if we imagine that Orkney Island could have been a later incarnation of that kind of a sanctuary, the first question that comes to my mind is, where's the safe haven for the teachers?
Right.
Because Orkney Island is right out in the middle of everything. There's no safe haven. Once you're on the island, there's no. It's not really a defensible spot.
Right.
Okay, so the linguistically and from a standpoint of common sense, the suggestion would be that the safe haven was just across the waters in the Faroe Islands. The word Faroe suggests that there, that's just as the word Faroese language suggests that there's a connection here. Now, in Egypt, the word Pharaoh didn't originally refer to a person, it referred to a place. And the names of the pharaohs ended up being written in hieroglyphs inside an oval cartouche that represents an island. Mm-hmm. So we have the pharaohs in Egypt associating themselves in numerous ways with concepts that we find at Orkney Island. There are connections to agriculture. There are connections to islands. There's connections to the concept of a pharaoh to begin with. Also, there are questions in Egypt as to where the pharaohs even came from.
Yeah.
No one is quite sure where they were. Now, what's interesting is that Orkney Island dates from around 3200 BC. Around 100 years later is when we see the establishment of agricultural kingships in four different locales.
Right. Yeah.
We find it in Egypt. We find it in China. We find it in the British Isles in Ireland. And we find it in South America. Now, an ancient name for Orkney Island being Aru. There is also an ancient name for Egypt that's Taru. There's an ancient name for China that is Eru, and an ancient name in South America that is Peru.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the prefixes there, the R, the Ta, the Ir, and the Pe, are four phonetic values in the Egyptian language that refer to sunrise, sunset, lower, and upper. We're talking about the four cardinal points.
Mm-hmm.
You also have the phonetic groups for four stages of agriculture. Ta represents an uncultivated field. R represents a planted field. Ir represents a field in which crops are growing. And Pe represents a granary. So we have a common set of four phonetic values and four names associated with four regional kingships that all appear at the same moment, founded on agriculture, 100 years after Orkney Island, where there are clear phonetic relationships, you know, relationships that are really suggestive that these things are connected with one another.
Well, see, that's very interesting. There's a lot more things I want to ask you about this when it comes to the what happened, and maybe this is one of the reasons why the site was basically just in use for that short amount of time. And it's, of course, the location is very interesting, right out in the Atlantic Ocean, the Faroe Islands being another completely different island further up to the north, where you have a lot more mountains and things like this. I definitely want to get into that a little bit later and ask you more about that, potentially what happened, and of course, and if they broke up this initial teaching center, if we can call it that, and then this spreads to other part of the world. But let's just talk about some of the upcoming books that you have about these topics. As I entered in the beginning here, I talked about The Point of Origin, which is the one that is coming out here shortly, and then a little bit later, well, I hope anyway, the Overthrown Boat, where you go into more Scarabrae stuff, is going to hopefully come out after that. But tell us what you have in the works there, Laird, and of course how people can get copies of your books.
Okay, well, the immediately impending book, the one that will be out at the end of February, is called Point of Origin. And effectively what it does is it finds a way to trace the symbolic elements that we see at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey to the other cultures I've studied in Africa and Egypt, in India, and Tibet and China. And it traces them through an archaic matriarchal cult that dates, according to the authorities who are most familiar with it, from time immemorial in India. It originates to the north and west of India up towards the Fertile Crescent region. The cult has as its earliest icons all of the symbolic elements that we find at Göbekli Tepe. It has standing stones and pillars, and circles of pillars are representative of it. Symbolic associations with animals. One of the more telling connections is actually a linguistic one. One of the key symbols of this early mother goddess was a clay pot that was filled with water that represented a womb, and is referred to as a pot belly. Well, one of the traditional translations of the term Göbekli Tepe is Potbelly Hill. It was named for the concept of a potbelly. So we have connections to this cult. We also have connections to ancient sanctuary names and archaic sanctuary names in Egypt, words that don't work the same way as more modernized Egyptian words. And these sanctuary names point us to sequences of deities who relate to star groups. And we can trace the names of these deities through these various cultures and demonstrate how each of them ties back in its own way. Part of the complication hinges on certain phonetic values. You can see in the Hebrew language in Judaism that there are certain phonetic values that under certain circumstances are pronounced one way, and other circumstances are pronounced another way. There are P's that become F's. There are G's that become H's or CH's. And there are a set of these things. And when you account for these differences in phonetics, you can demonstrate how certain of these key archaic words survived in one form in India and in a different form in Egypt and yet another form someplace else. You can even trace them to Scandinavia, to the Faroese language, to the Gaelic language, and so forth. Fundamental root values that this archaic cult in India has myths associated with it that are versions of familiar ancient Egyptian myths, only they're given in relation to a mother goddess rather than a creator god. For example, the myth of Osiris being dismembered and then re-assimilated is originally given in this archaic tradition in terms of a goddess, a mother goddess named Sati. And you have connections from this Indian tradition. You can see linguistic connections to Orkney Island, where certain values play out in terms of words that have meaning for us in Tamil language and in the Turkish language and in these languages that connect forward to the Dogon and so forth.
Yeah.
So the upshot of it is we have influences that we trace from 10,000 BC that are direct influences on places like Egypt and China and so forth like that. You have a later set of influences that come through India, again into Egypt at a later period of time. You have what looked to be a set of influences from Orkney Island that come into Egypt just before dynastic Egypt, the establishment of dynastic kingship. And it's the interplay of these sets of influences that create the really complex set of symbols and word forms that we have in Egypt.
Very good, very good. There's of course, a lot more here, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the second segment here, Laird, as we pick up and continue. I would give out the publisher's website, Inner Traditions, and, of course, the book that we're talking about here, Point of Origin, is going to be available here. When was the date again, you said, Laird?
It's scheduled for the end of February of 2015, so a couple of months.
There you go. Exactly. So we can't have that link up on the website yet, but have a look.
Yeah, actually you can. The book's available for pre-sale. It's actually been selling as well or better than some of the other books I've written.
Well, there you go.
Which is interesting.
All right. There we go. Well, that's good. Okay. Well, good. Excellent. I'll do a quick search and actually on Inner Traditions and make sure that that's up on our website as well. And then, of course,
there's also a page from Simon & Schuster. There's a Laird's Grant page there that people can go to. The books are all available on Amazon or through any of the regular outlets. Some of them are being carried by Barnes & Noble. You can find China's Cosmological Prehistory in Barnes & Noble right now.
Right, great. Yeah, exactly. And you got to set up a website, Laird. You got to have your own website, right?
there is a LairdsGrant.com, but it's actually a fan site. And contact tab does reach me, and I do answer contacts from the tab, but it's not officially my site.
Okay, well, that's good. That's something at least. We'll make sure to link to that as well. All right, well, we'll pick this up here after a short break, folks. So stay with us, and we'll be right back with more. Well, we're going to pick this up in the second hour as we continue in our member section, as we do, and we have more to discuss when it comes to Orkney Islands, the ancient settlements there, and the Faroe Islands as well. I also mentioned something as to the suggestion of who built Skara Brau. First off, even if we can associate Herodotus' description of the Orkney Islands based on the geography that he cites, it's still difficult to confirm the words of someone who writes in the 5th century BC about the suggestion that African pygmies were behind the building of the settlements at Orkney, as this is several thousand years before his statements. So Herodotus uses the term melashkros, black-complexioned, to describe someone at an island in the west at the edge of the world. But the fact is that the lack of physical remains leaves us guessing. And as you well know, if you listen to our previous shows, it's become quite fashionable to reach out in a constrained fashion for the out-of-Africa theory, which, by the way, Russian scientists recently has debunked. And keep in mind that they actually are still in a position where they can do proper science, as opposed to our Western political correct scientific field that we get fed today. That's part of the leukophobia and the anti-white agenda. So I frankly personally put little credence to the Afrocentrism that we've seen pushed on us in the recent years, as it's a relative recent invention. This of course doesn't mean that there weren't people traveling all over the place many, many thousands of years ago. But there's also the suggestion of course that the first Egyptians were black Africans. That could very well be the case, despite the earliest art in Egypt looks more like it belongs in the Lascaux caves of France, but it doesn't remove us from the controversy that has been raging in the last few years about who the Egyptians really were, from Nubians to Caucasians, and of course then you have a different aspect of the pharaohs themselves, as we have claims of European DNA belonging to the haplogroup R1b, allegedly found among the mummies. But any of this is still not conclusive as far as I know. All of this is very much up in the air, as the studies are never really released. We can't really get an answer on this. But you also have the description of the Elysian fields that, according to Homer, were located on the western edge of the earth by the stream of Okeanos. Greek poet Hesiod said that Elysium also was known as the Fortunate Isles, or the Isle of the Blessed, located in the western ocean at the end of the earth. So this could very well be Orkney Island. And if we go back to Homer in the Odyssey, he describes the ruler of Elysium as the fair-haired Rhadamanthus. And this could very well be the Peti, or the Picts, that has the earliest claims to the island, as far as archaeology tells us right now. But these accounts are, despite everything, several thousand years after the time of Skara Brá, and he doesn't say anything about who actually built the Neolithic settlement. Now, today, Orkney has the per capita largest accumulation of Viking DNA, for example, and this is due to the fact that Nordic countries have had waves of immigration from other European countries during the 16th, 17th, and 1800s. Personally, I think that the Afrocentrism that has worked itself into alternative megalithic research is unfortunate. It plays right into the hands of the weaponized anthropology that we spoke with Frank Salter about. This comes from the types of Franz Boas and Stephen Jay Gould, who, as we know, if we look at the Frankfurt School, had a very different agenda than what was based on actual science. And this has also been picked up by people like, Francesca Kress-Walsing, who wrote the ISIS Papers, The Keys to Color, in basically where she lays out the proposition that white people are the genetically defective descendants of albino mutants expelled from Africa. And she has a heavy lean on Freudianism as well. And we know how the fraud of Freud has been used against us to demoralize us. Anyway, we'll pick this up right after the break, so join us at redicemembers.com as we continue to talk about Skara Brá with Laird Scranton. We'll be right back.